This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Late last month, Utah lawmakers called themselves into special session. Legislative leaders were upset about a state Supreme Court ruling that said they had overstepped their authority when they rewrote a citizen's ballot initiative. The court said the state constitution gives Utahns the political power to reshape its government. But what lawmakers did at their special session was basically drop a ballot initiative of their own. And it said that despite what the court had just ruled, legislators had the right to take these propositions that had already been voted on and passed by citizens and change them or even repeal them altogether if they wanted. Lawmakers wanted to add this language to the state's constitution. They called it Amendment D, and the plan was to put it to voters in November. We're going to be talking about Amendment D today, but before we get there, we have to go back to 2018. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune says this is an important moment in the story because even though Utah citizens have had the power to put these propositions on the ballot for more than a century now, there haven't been that many that have actually passed. But in 2018, something happened.
We're back now to break down two of the big issues on the ballot, medical marijuana and Medicaid expansion.
In 2018, we had this sort of unprecedented perfect storm where there were three ballot initiatives that all cleared the hurdles to get on the ballot. One of them would have created a legalized medical marijuana program in the state. One of them would have expanded Medicaid. And the third one,
Proposition 4, which deals with redistricting,
would have done away with partisan gerrymandering.
Talk about what it would do if it were to pass in November.
So when it passes,
all three of these made it onto the ballot, and surprisingly, all three of them passed. The gerrymandering one in particular, it was behind by 920 votes on election night. There were about 10,000 ballots left to be counted, and slowly over time, it whittled away at that and ended up passing by about 6,400 votes. But the election night victory was fairly short-lived, because the legislature significantly rewrote all three of them. The medical marijuana initiative was changed dramatically after meetings with the LDS Church, but there was, at the end of the day, still a medical marijuana program. The Medicaid expansion program was altered, but at the end of the day, there were going to be low-income Utahns who were still covered by it. The redistricting one was different. The legislature removed that part of the law that banned partisan gerrymandering completely, leaving it sort of a shell of itself. It caused a lot of frustration and consternation among the people who had worked so hard to get these passed. Why did we spend all this money and all this time gathering these signatures to try to change the law only to have the legislature come back and change it back to what they wanted? In 2021, the legislature went ahead and drew the boundaries that they decided that they wanted. It split Salt Lake County, one of the more liberal parts of the state, into four districts. And critics said at the time that that was clearly done to benefit the Republican candidates, to the detriment of the Democratic candidates, and ended up disenfranchising a whole slew of people who live in Salt Lake County. The League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government sued over that and said that the legislature had overstepped its bounds when it had repealed that citizen initiative. That litigation proceeded up until July of this year when the Utah Supreme Court said, yeah, you're right. If the citizens exercise this constitutional right to alter their government, the legislature needs to give deference to that. So the legislature was unsurprisingly outraged by that court decision. In their eyes, the courts should not be telling them what they can and can't do. They're the legislative body. They should have the ability to snap their fingers like Thanos and make these ballot initiatives go away. So they convened an emergency special session in August and said, we're going to change this. And the outcome of that was this Amendment D. Now, what Amendment D does, basically, is it puts in the Constitution language that says that the legislature at any time can repeal or amend, rewrite ballot initiatives that citizens pass for any reason that they want. The Utah Constitution says that all political power is inherent in the people. If the legislature then can undo ballot initiatives anytime it wants after the people have gone through this arduous process and have raised all this money and spent all this time and effort trying to get a ballot initiative passed, well, then we're back to where we started, where the ballot initiative becomes essentially meaningless. the legislature would take the Constitution back to 1899 before the citizens gained this right. So this is really, at its core, a constitutional showdown between the legislature and the voters of Utah.
So there's just one more wrinkle to add to the story before we can dig in here. And this happened just last week. Third District Judge Diana Gibson voided Amendment D. She said the ballot language written by the legislature did not fairly and accurately summarize what they were trying to get voters to approve. And not only that, she said the language left out the most important part, what she called the chief feature, that the legislature had the unlimited right to change laws passed by citizen initiative. When you leave that part out, she ruled, the ballot is counterfactual. Robert Gerke is with us today to talk about all of this. We also have with us Sage Miller of KUER News and David Magleby. He's an emeritus professor of political science at Brigham Young University. Robert Gerke says this dispute over Amendment D fits into what seems like a trend by Utah lawmakers over the years to expand their power.
We've talked on the show before about how over the last couple decades, the legislature's become this vortex of power, and it's chipping away power from the local governments. It's chipping away power from the governor's office. It's just accruing more and more power over time. And this is about whether it's taking that power away from the voters, this power that they've had since 1900. They don't like being told no by the courts or by voters, but those are two checks that remain in place that keep the legislature's power somewhat limited. And this would remove those fundamentally, at least the voters' check. And also, you know, kind of strike a blow at the courts, I think, too, by overturning the July Supreme Court ruling, by potentially overturning Judge Gibson's order that keeps Amendment D off. So, yeah, it's about voters preserving the limited and rarely used power that they have to step in and make laws themselves. Is the political power inherent in the people, or is it then becoming inherent in the legislature?
I think that the legislature in this scenario is trying to preserve the power that they feel that they are entitled to. They're saying that they are co-equals to the people. So they have the ability to alter and reform the government that the people are arguing for, advocating for. And so when they got this Supreme Court ruling saying that actually, no, your threshold to overturn the will of the voters or even alter a ballot initiative is much higher than you initially thought, they took that as a blow. They were like, that's not how we interpret the Constitution. So they're saying, let's pose this question to the people to see if they believe that we have just as much power as them. In this scenario.
What they're saying, though, it seems like what you're saying is lawmakers are saying, look, we're not just potted plants here. We are representatives of the government. You can't just turn this over to citizens. We have a part to play, too.
We have a part to play, too, and we have a voice in what the voters have said and what they have voted on, because in the grand scheme of things, we know how policymaking works. The people don't. So sometimes when they have the intent of a ballot initiative and that passes, sometimes there needs to be tweaks. And what the Supreme Court is telling us is that we can't make any of these tweaks. However, that's not what the Supreme
Court said. Right, right. We'll get to that in a moment. David Magleby, does this sound right to you in terms of the...
It is about power. And I would change one word in Sage's analysis just a moment ago. It's not about being equal to the people. It's about being superior to the people. What the legislature is saying is that they want to make the initiative in Utah advisory only. And if it's advisory only, the legislature can completely disregard it. It's not equal. It's inferior to the legislature. That's the power grab here. The power grab is to say, well, you can put whatever you want on the ballot, but we can disregard it, and we've written language in this new amendment that says that. So it is not a co-equal, as we would have with checks and balances in a normal governmental system in the U.S. It's a superior position, and that's why it's so important.
I wanted to ask you about what seems to be the kind of the pattern, the way Utah lawmakers have dealt with these citizens' initiatives over the last several years. Certainly in 2018, Robert Gerke, you sort of set part of this up for us. But basically, it seems like the pattern is when Utah citizens try these ballot initiatives and they seem successful, or they are successful, lawmakers go in and kind of swap the language for their own version of that. Is that sort of how it has worked in the past?
In the recent past, yes. Yeah. You're referencing the 2018 ballot initiatives, the one that expanded Medicaid, that created or legalized medical marijuana, and then this the one that prohibited partisan gerrymandering. In each of those three cases, they significantly rewrote the initiative language. There's a distinction, though, that probably needs to be made. In the case of the medical marijuana thing, and to be clear, the people who were behind those ballot initiatives were really frustrated with the way the legislature tinkered with it. And the public, I think, came out of that saying, well, why would we run a ballot initiative ever again if we're going to put all this time and effort and money into it and then have it, you know, completely undone by the legislature? But there's a distinction, I think, between the gerrymandering initiative and the other two, because the public voted to have a medical marijuana program. And even though the legislature significantly rewrote that with input from the LDS Church and other stakeholders, there is in Utah right now a medical marijuana program.
They did go with them, at least in this part.
Yeah, they completely rewrote the Medicaid expansion. That some of it needed to be rewritten. Some of the language was in error and some of it just needed to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And today we have Medicaid expansion and we have a lot of Utahns who are being covered, low-income Utahns who are being covered by that program. The gerrymandering one is different, and the court noted this key difference in that core of that was that we don't want the legislature to draw lines on a partisan basis to benefit one party over the other. And when they rewrote that one, they took that completely out. So that's the key distinction. You know, as David mentioned, they sometimes honor the intent of what the public is doing, and the public can be, as he put it, an advisory body, I guess, in their mind. But in the case of the gerrymandering one, they completely reversed the core principle of that ballot initiative.
I want to come back to the language that Utah lawmakers chose for Amendment D. Judge Gibson ruled that it was deceptive, that it could mislead voters into actually giving up their rights. What are you seeing in that language? Orwellian doublespeak is one of the terms used by attorneys who were, of course, opposed to the Amendment D language, who challenged it in court. I guess the question is, I'm not sure if you can assess the motives of lawmakers. Was it intentionally designed to be just confusing and misleading, as far as you can tell?
I mean, I guess I'll take this. I think it's important to note that the reason that we ended up in this situation with this particular language is earlier this year, the legislature, the Republicans in the legislature, there was two or three lines in a pretty massive bill that said instead of having nonpartisan attorneys for the legislature write the ballot language, we turned it over to the House Speaker and the Senate President. So they got to structure the question in the way that best suited them. I think they also recognize that because ballot initiatives are wildly popular in this state, polling has showed 90%+ support for the ballot initiative process, they needed to dress this up in a way that voters might go along with it. So they lead with this provision that would ban foreign influence in future ballot initiatives and referendum. And we can talk about what that means.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, we've never had foreign influence in ballot initiatives in the past, but they've heard stories from other states like Maine, where Canada got involved in a ballot initiative there and spent some money. The Canadian Power Company spent some money there to try to pass a ballot initiative. So I think that, you know, they put that foreign involvement piece front and center and say, do you want to strengthen the initiative process by banning foreign influence in ballot initiatives and clarifying the role of the respective, you know, the legislature with respect to the public? I think clearly they recognized that they were going to have a problem selling this to the public, and they wanted to, A, dress it up with this foreign influence piece, and B, you know, downplay the real practical effect of it. It doesn't say, do you want to overturn a Utah Supreme Court ruling that protects ballot initiatives? But at its core, that's what it does.
Well, Sage Miller, you talked to – I think you mentioned two people in particular who thought it was referring to non-citizens voting in Utah elections.
Yeah. So one thing that I was really curious about this as I read it, my head has been in this game, right? I've been following Amendment D. I've been following the saga. Like I'm very entrenched in this. So I decided to print out the constitutional amendment language drafted by legislative leadership. And I went down to the University of Utah campus and I just started approaching people. I handed them the piece of paper and I said, read this. Don't read it out loud because you'll get confused. But like just read it to yourself.
And tell me what it means.
And tell me what you think it means, right? And every single person we talked to, and I'm not saying we talked to everybody on the University of Utah campus, we talked to probably roughly a dozen people, yeah. and every single person said they believed that this was strengthening the initiative process by giving voters more of a say in how ballot initiatives are ran, more say in how the legislative body conducts laws and amends them. And two people did say when they first read it, they believed that this was prohibiting non-citizens from being able to vote in Utah elections, which has been a national conversation, mostly in Washington and also spearheaded by Utah's own Senator Mike Lee. So
they thought it was a good thing.
They thought it was a good thing. They thought it was overwhelmingly positive. And then when we broke it down and kind of told them the saga, you know, like the too long didn't read version of what was happening, people called it misleading. They called it knowingly nebulous. They said it was lacking clarification. They said it was deceptive. And all of them were very unaware of that's what the intent of the ballot initiative was. Like what they thought the exact opposite. So
well, David Magleby, this is something you've actually looked into. You did a study of the kind of readability of some of these measures. One of the things you mentioned is it was just not reasonable to expect the sort of conventional voter to understand the language. Sometimes they use these double negatives. Is this a concerted effort to be vague?
Well, yes, on the part of many states, not just Utah, and on many initiative proponents. So when a petition process starts in most states, the title, the short title, a matter of a few words, 8 to 10 words, is perhaps the most important, because that's what voters who haven't had a chance to pay a lot of attention, read the voter guide, etc., are going to react to. So in this case, strengthening the initiative as a short title for a measure is going to evoke the kind of response that Sage and Robert have described. But that's misleading here, as the judge correctly points out. And for those who dig into and read more about the language, in many states that's written by lawyers, and it's highly technical language. So voters end up not sure. When we did the study of readability of ballot summaries, it was written at the 18th grade level. That's a graduate degree, an MBA, or a second-year law student. Most people can't digest that. So, yes, the summary is very important. In this case, it's not surprising that Sage found what she found, and I suspect the people who were behind this did some testing of the wording because it's so critical. And therefore, I'm not at all surprised that they went with a title that evoked a very positive initial reaction.
David Magleby, he's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. We also have with us Sage Miller, politics reporter at KUER, and reporter Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fate of Amendment D. It's an amendment to the state constitution drawn up by Utah lawmakers. And they did this because they were upset that the state Supreme Court had ruled they had overstepped their authority when they rewrote a citizen's ballot initiative. Amendment D says lawmakers have the right to change these ballot initiatives or even repeal them altogether, though just last week, a judge voided Amendment D. We have with us Sage Miller of KUER News, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, and also David Magleby of Brigham Young University. So in the debate over the gerrymandering proposition, the governor, Governor Cox, has argued that the legislature, this is how he put it, has the ultimate authority to draw congressional maps and to amend legislation passed by initiative. And the governor's statement said preserving the ability of lawmakers to amend these citizens' initiatives would – and here's the term I want to ask you about – would protect against pure democracy's problems. David Magleby, what does he mean when he says the problems of pure democracy?
Well, I don't know for sure. I'd be interested in the governor's answer to your question, Doug. That's the tension here. It's always been a tension. In U.S. history, the founders were very much uncomfortable with the notion of too much direct democracy, and referred to it in some of their debates in Philadelphia. But it was the progressive era in the first two decades of the last century when reformers wanted to give more power to the people and let the voters decide became, in essence, their mantra. And they did it in three fundamental ways. One was the direct election of U.S. senators, which the founders had left in the hands of the states, and that was largely state legislatures. It was also the direct primary, which allowed voters to decide who got to run under the party label in elections. And it was then this process we're talking about today, direct legislation, which allows voters to put on the ballot initiatives like we've had in Utah, or in some cases, what we call popular referendums, where the voters can hold up a legislative action for ratification. In that case, it reverses what we're talking about here. The legislature becomes advisory to the voters. And that was all litigated, as I said, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was upheld that it was consistent with the U.S. Constitution that voters could have the right to initiate laws or have a popular referendum. And so we have gradually in this country become more small D democratic, allowing voters more and more of a role. Perhaps Governor Cox wants to go back to the legislature choosing senators. I don't know. But that's a debate long since passed. What we're talking about now is how to make the process of citizen engagement and involvement fair and reasonable and legitimate. And that's why I think his evoking this is unclear and I think not very productive, actually, because it's a window dressing for a power grab. That is the legislature saying, nope, we have and have to have the ultimate say.
But what about the larger question that seemed to me he was getting at, and that is some of the questions that you've been writing about in your own work, whether or not – I mean, one of the questions you ask in your book is when there's direct democracy, will there be majority tyranny? What effect will it have on fundamental rights and liberties and the capacity to govern if you hand this over to citizens who might not have been thinking as – this is obviously the argument that Utah lawmakers make. Look, this is our jobs to work through this stuff. If you're an insurance agent and you're making – you know, and you're living your life and going to, you know, coaching soccer or whatever, you're not thinking as deeply about this stuff. So what happens to the capacity to govern if you hand that decision over to this citizen, because it does seem fair to at least suggest that this could vastly complicate things, as Utah lawmakers say it did in California, and we can sort of talk about what they mean there, but respond to that point, if you would.
Well, I'll be happy to. I think it's all about checks and balances and trying to keep the system in balance with popular input through elections, and in states that have allowed this, the initiative or referendum. But the voters do not have absolute power either, just like the legislature does not or should not. And because the voters should not have absolute power, who then is the check on the voters? And the answer is very clear. It's the courts. It's a brave thing for courts to do, but in the California case of open housing, that is laws in California that had been in place to restrict the sale of housing to racial minorities, blacks in this case, Rumford versus California Open Housing Act. The Supreme Court said the voters have rights here, but they do not have the rights to take away other people's constitutional rights. So there are limits on what voters can do. And you have to have somebody that tells the voters that. And that happens to have been in our system, the courts. And courts have frequently overridden popular votes, sometimes 60% or more of the voters voting one way, and the court saying, you can't do that.
So in your book, you ask, does direct democracy, do these kinds of citizens' initiatives, do they enhance the democratic process or detract from it? Sounds like you've come to the conclusion they, when done right, enhance it.
I do think in some states they play a vital role. In other states, they can create a cumbersome role. So let me contrast Utah with California to answer your question. Utah provides only for the statutory initiative, not a constitutional initiative. Voters cannot amend the Utah Constitution by initiative. They can in California. And because of that, a lot of measures in California that are really statutory become constitutional initiatives. Second, Utah makes it very hard to get on the ballot. second hardest state in the country, only Wyoming more difficult. California and many other initiative-prone states make it very easy, much lower signature thresholds, and therefore they have crowded ballots. In California, you can have initiatives, constitutional and statutory, in primary elections, as well as general elections. It is not uncommon, therefore, for California to have as many as 20 different yes-no votes on a primary ballot or a general election ballot. That's too much, in my judgment. It's too hard for voters to process that many issues. And I documented, as you've alluded to, the implications in terms of voters quitting voting on measures as they go down that long ballot and so forth. So I think it's a question of the state political culture and the provisions. It can go too far. I think it has gone too far in some states like California, Washington, and Colorado. But I don't think it has provided enough of a check on power in Utah. And therefore, I think it is important that Judge Gibson ruled as she did and that the state Supreme Court ruled as it did, because the court is the only one that's going to protect the voters in terms of this process here.
Robert, I wanted to, one of the things you've mentioned in your writing is that California is often invoked in these arguments as this, this is how you put it, is this dystopian democracy run amok, what do you make about the use of, well, we don't want to be like California, because yeah, they, that's what lawmakers have sort of essentially said.
The night of the special session, and Sage was there, we heard that over and over again from Senate President Stuart Adams, don't turn Utah into California, or don't California Utah, right? It is this boogeyman out there. And I think, you know, as David mentioned, it is overwhelming, I think, sometimes how many ballot initiatives they have. And it's trying to, you know, it comes back to striking the right balance. That's what Governor Cox, I think, was referring to when he said the problems of what were his words exactly? Direct democracy.
Yeah. Pure democracy.
Pure democracy. Yeah. So, yes, that's one of the major arguments against it. As David noted, you need about 550,000 signatures out of 22 million voters in California to get something on the ballot. Here it's almost 140,000 out of about 1.5, 1.6 million. So you can see the disparity or how much harder it is here. You've got to get those signatures across the state. They've got to get it be a representative number in each of in each Senate district, and then the opponents can go back and try to get the signatures knocked off the ballot. Then you've got to have these public meetings across the state. Then you've got to spend a couple million bucks running a campaign. It's really, really difficult to get a ballot initiative passed here, and I think, you know, that's why we've only had, up until 2018, we'd only had four in 118 years in the state, right? So then we had this sort of shocking, you know, earthquake where
in 2018
where all three of them passed, but it's a last resort, I think, for not, you know, Cox talks about the problems of pure democracy. It's a last resort for people who feel like the democracy is not their representative government is not representing them, because in each of those three cases we talked about in 2018, there was broad public support for medical marijuana, for Medicaid expansion, to prohibit gerrymandering. The polls had showed this for a number of years leading up to that election, that's what the voters wanted. And you know, there were bills introduced, but they never got close to passing. And so it was the only thing left, I think, at that point. So that's why I think it goes back to what David was saying, is trying to find a balance where yes, it is a viable alternative, and it's not something that the legislature can simply undo on a whim. But also it remains a high enough bar that we're not, you know, it's not turning into a free-for-all.
Yeah, I think it's just rhetoric. I think that in order for Utah to become California, you'd have to massively reform the ballot initiative process in Utah. And that's not what they're doing. That's not what the courts did, right? Like, essentially, all they are saying is your threshold, Utah legislature, is now higher if you want to undo or make changes to ballot approved initiatives. They're not saying you need to lower the signature threshold count. They're not saying that you need to up the time it takes in order to gather the appropriate amount of signatures. They're not saying you shouldn't hold public meetings. Like, they're not changing anything about the process that it takes to get an initiative on the ballot at all.
And you just have to be very clear when you're talking to citizens about what they're voting for. Is that what they're saying?
Well, the court said that if it is a If it is an initiative that alters or reforms government, it's held to strict scrutiny. There has to be a compelling state interest to undo the will of the people. But everything else, all of the changes, there's the court didn't say this in its ruling, but it would appear that the changes they made to the medical marijuana initiative would not be challenged because you can make changes, the court said, to facilitate or the implementation of the people's will. You can make changes if there's a compelling state interest. They didn't say you can't touch it ever, and mm-hmm. that sort of goes.
And that's
this
argument that the legislature is making, right? That's what they're trying to signal to voters is that their hands can't be on it anymore once the voters pass it. And that's not what's happening.
And that's not what their own attorneys have told them, actually. I've got a memo from their own attorneys that says that what they're saying about these super laws is not what they're being told by legislative counsel.
Robert Gerke, one of the things you've written about this, it's rare. Mm-hmm. The citizens initiative process, you said since 1952, something like 26 ballot initiatives have qualified, only 7 passed.
Yeah.
So what are citizens – what does that tell you about Utah citizens? A lot of these seemed pretty conservative, like fluoride and English only. Like what are Utah citizens interested in when they – go for a ballot initiative, does it seem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is interesting because the second one, I believe, that passed was this opposition to mandatory fluoridation of water, right? Yeah. So that's not something that's a, you know, lefty, you know, socialist California initiative. Making English the official language was one that passed, and that's certainly not a lefty issue, you know. So this doesn't necessarily cut one way or the other politically, which I think is part of the reason the legislature knew it had a problem on its hands, because it does cut across parties. The polling has shown that among Democrats, Republicans, and independents, this is popular. So yeah, it's, as we mentioned before, very, very difficult to get these on. But it's not always, you know, one way or the other. You've just got to have an issue that resonates with voters and has some financial backing behind it, which is one of the things the legislature has said that they're concerned about, is outside special interest groups coming in and spending millions of dollars to try to reshape Utah. And I think that probably is especially present if there's, say, an alcohol reform initiative, which there have been.
But there have been, and he didn't move forward with it.
There have been a couple proposed, even in the past, going back to, I think, 68. There was an alcohol reform initiative proposed, and it was defeated. You know, so a lot of these get proposed. You know, there have probably been hundreds of them over the years that have been proposed. About 26 of them, 29 of them on the ballot that have made it to the ballot. But again, only 7 have passed. And that just, I think, speaks again to how onerous the process is and how I think the public's a little wary of, you know, making big changes at the ballot box, you know. So, yeah, Utah has, I guess, maybe a complicated relationship with it. But it goes, again, back to the difficulty of the process.
Anything unique you see in the Utah process, David Magleby or Sage?
I think it's just, I mean, there's not a lot of states that even have this process to begin with, right? So that already makes Utah pretty unique. But I mean, like, I'm from Oregon, right? And Oregon, I wasn't able to vote in Oregon because I was 18 when I moved here. But like, Oregon has a pretty simplistic process to get ballot initiatives on. And when I hear my mom talk about them, the conversation is much different here. Like, I rarely ever see them. I see more constitutional amendments on the ballot than I ever do a citizen reform initiative on the ballot, right? And so I do know that it's pretty hard. And I do think that with the citizens here is that when they're taking all of the effort, all the time, all the money to try and get something to land on the ballot, it's because of one of two things. It's something the legislature won't take up or something they can't get done. So in one word, one way or another, they're saying, well, the legislature isn't doing this job because they can't pass this. So I guess it is on the people to get this done. And that's what you saw in 2018 with those 3 initiatives that did pass, that there was a large amount of turnout in that election period. But then also that there was just barely enough support on all 3 of them in order to pass. And that's enough. And so we have seen the legislature kind of be concerned with just having the majority of wanting to toy with this idea of increasing the threshold it takes for a ballot initiative to be passed to 60% instead of 50%, which hasn't passed. So it's still 50%. But we have seen them kind of get scared that people do, in some aspects, respond to ballot initiatives. And as a way, is almost seeing that maybe perhaps as a power threat to where we need to increase the threshold. So it's not a simple majority anymore.
David Magleby.
I think it's important to note that it's easier to defeat than to pass a ballot initiative. And that's because voters have a kind of almost instinctive reaction to when in doubt, vote no. And so the no side on ballot initiatives and referendums starts out with a pretty good advantage. They just have to create some doubts. And often there's something about the measure that you can do that. So campaigns on initiatives can often be quite misleading, with some tangent becoming the defining element of the measure. But Utah voters, I think, have been quite remarkable in some ways. The best example of that is the tax revolt started by a Utahn from Grantsville named Howard Jarvis, who had moved to California and started Proposition 13. But he actually had run others before and been defeated. But when the property tax cut passed in California, it went national. It became a major element of politics nationally for a period. And there was our own Howard Jarvis in Utah named Merrill Cook, who was on the same wavelength and placed three measures on the ballot during the Bangor administration. And there was a lot of concern about taxes and the pumps in the West Desert and other kinds of things. And if you had asked me or others who study this process, well, voters are going to vote to lower their taxes. That's kind of a no-brainer. And it was an intense campaign. But it came quite interestingly to the conclusion that the voters voted no on all three of Merrill Cook's tax cut and vote voucher system for education measures. And similarly, there have been other measures like the voucher system in Utah that voters voted no. So I think there is a kind of a crowd wisdom that can arise in these instances if the campaign has sufficient resources and can effectively help voters understand what it's all about. The danger becomes when there's so many measures that it's hard to figure out where to vote yes and where to vote no and how to navigate the process. But that's not been the experience in Utah.
But if you are a Republican lawmaker, if you're a lawmaker and you're a Republican, and that's how it works these days, don't you have a distinct advantage in this sense? If someone is going to try to stop this effort to limit citizen power, it seems like it's, you know, it's going to have to be the courts, because right now, will the citizens actually be will they retaliate against Utah lawmakers for doing this? Because it doesn't seem like right now residents are going to vote for anyone other than, for the most part, a Republican candidate. So aren't they insulated from these kinds of reprisals and consequences of overreaching? They can just do this anyway.
I think yes and no. I think in the districts that are deeply red and that are incredibly safe, you are fine. In the swing districts, I think that it comes a little bit more worrisome to them. So, for example, Gerke, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was 9 Republicans that voted no on Amendment D getting on the ballot.
All in swing districts.
And most of them were in swing districts, huh. Yes. Mostly Salt Lake County. There was Marcia Judkins in the Provo area. She's not running for re-election. And then there was Ray Ward in Davis County, who usually does have a pretty competitive district, but he usually ends up winning anyway. But then the rest of them were in Salt Lake County, where it seems to be very deeply unpopular, where you – and I understand that social media is not real life, right? But I have never seen so much uproar from Utahns on social media about Amendment D, on Reddit, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, all of them saying, vote them out. And in swing districts like Salt Lake County, like the west side of Salt Lake City and of Salt Lake County, that is a possibility where Republicans do lose their seats. And those are the Republicans that voted no on this ballot amendment.
Sage Miller is a politics reporter here at KUER. She's joined by David Magleby, a professor emeritus at the Political Science Department at Brigham Young University, and Robert Gerke. He's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Amendment D. It's a
constitutional amendment drawn up by Utah lawmakers that would give them power to change or repeal citizens' initiatives. Last week, a judge voided Amendment D, and so we're talking about what happens now. We've also been discussing one of the questions BYU professor David Magleby has written about. Do these citizen ballot proposals enhance the democratic process, or do they detract from it? Back now to our conversation. Along with Professor Magleby, we have Sage Miller of KUER and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune.
So the leader of this group called People for Utah said something I wanted to ask you about. Barbara
Stallone.
She said that the ruling from the court is about, this is how she put it, legislators being responsive to their voters. If they were responsive, she said, citizens' initiatives would seldom happen. And I wanted to get your sense of what you think about that, that this process at all is just because citizens don't feel like lawmakers are in tune or in line with their own kind of needs or politics. And then here's a second part to this question. How would voters, do you think, change the Utah landscape if they could have more access to these initiatives? Like, how would they change it? Would it be a more kind of moderate sort of state? Would there be anarchy like in California? Like, what do you imagine? How do you respond to those questions? David Magleby, you first.
That's a very thought-provoking question, Doug. I think the answer is the data on past measures that came from a variety of perspectives. I'm thinking about the tax cut measures, for example, suggest to me that Utah voters would respond responsibly. It would create a more competitive or more contentious political environment. So we have had votes on morals kinds of questions, cable TV decency. We had a vote on parimutuel gambling. Most people had to go to their dictionary to figure out what parimutuel was. Is it an insurance company? And so forth. And that's another example of ballot wording, by the way. So I think voters would navigate it well, and we could probably benefit from voters feeling like they have a little more say than they seem to feel they have right now in Utah.
You have a hunch? You too?
I think we can look at what's been proposed, as David said, in the past to sort of give us an indication of what we might see in the future. Immediately after the court's ruling, I did talk to several people who've run these initiative campaigns or worked on them in some capacity.
You said the floodgates are open.
They had been contacted by several groups who are interested in getting one of these off the ground. And Barbara Stallone's group, People for Utah, wants to open up change the primary system where Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everybody goes on a primary ballot and the top two advance to the general election regardless of party. And so that's something they're already kind of working on. Mm-hmm. Last year, there was an effort to try to run an alcohol initiative, and there's been talk about that in the legislature for a while just to loosen up the liquor laws a little bit. I think we can look to that unifying theme that those three in 2018 had was that there was broad public support for them before the initiative was started, and it was stymied by the legislature because nobody's going to wake up, you know, whether the Supreme Court puts it back on the ballot, whether the amendment passes, nobody's going to wake up one day and go, I have this idea that I'd like to do. I'm going to go gather 140,000 signatures.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
You write a letter to your legislator at that point and say, hey, why don't we try this first? So it's those things that have been kind of blocked by the legislature that have public support that I think you could actually see some movement on. And those, you know, that's good because that applies that pressure on the legislature to be responsive to its voters because they know that if they don't, then the initiative becomes that fallback position, right? They don't have to worry about losing their elections, most of them. But if they're not responsive to their voters on this, on these issues with broad public support, then, you know, the initiative then becomes the last resort for groups that want to see change.
I mean, I kind of 100% echo what Gerke just said. I think that, like I said earlier, is that these initiatives are pretty much a last step process to deal with things the legislature won't take up or can't get done. And I think before they go through the gruesome process to try and put something on a ballot, they're going to make sure that there's wide public support for it, or they're going to have case studies that show this has worked in other places before they get it. And with, is it People for Utah? I find that very interesting. And I think the legislature may be a little bit scared of that because it's on the ballot in Idaho. And Idaho does have a kind of a similar demographic when it comes to a voting population as Utah. So if it passes in Idaho, like, is there a way for there to be an appetite here in Utah, especially as we've seen people becoming very disengaged with partisan politics and wanting to learn more about policy or the candidate rather than their party affiliation? So I do think that there's some worry on the legislative part. Are people going to start pounding the pavement and throwing up thousands and millions of dollars to try and put something on the ballot? I don't think so. And I think what they do is going to be widely supported.
David Megley, you have called Judge Gibson's ruling brave, which raises the question, could lawmakers retaliate against her or other, you know, members of the judicial branch?
The answer is yes, in some ways. So should she ever be considered to be an appointee for the state Supreme Court, I think they could retaliate against her in that way. There could be an effort to have a judicial retention election effort here. That happened in California with Chief Justice Rose Byrd and two associate justices who had ruled in a way that was unpopular in California on these measures, and they were removed from the state Supreme Court. So depends on the state, depends on the rules, but we have judicial retention elections. And so judges must have in the back of their mind the question of, could this cost me this job? I suspect Judge Gibson took a substantial cut in pay when she became a judge. And Doug, one final point on that, and speculative, but I think interesting. When courts are under threat and having to make a decision on a fundamental right, I'm thinking of Brown versus Board of Education and school integration. History teaches us that the court tends to try and speak in a unified voice. I found it fascinating that the state Supreme Court on the redistricting case voted unanimously, 5-0. I thought there was a chance it might be a 3-2 decision either way, but I was genuinely surprised that it was 5-0. And I speculate that that may be because there's a sense among the justices that they need to speak with a unified voice on fundamental constitutional rights.
It's a good segue into the final question. What do you all think is going to happen? Will the state Supreme Court overrule Judge Gibson's ruling? Friday, lawmakers asked the court for an emergency order. Any sense of what might happen, Sage?
I think they uphold Gibson's decision. Again, with the unified voice, I think they respect their colleagues and they probably respect her decision. And additionally, they're asking the Supreme Court to rule on something they already ruled on, essentially, when it comes to redistricting. And they were pretty clear that the people have the right to alter and reform their government through the ballot initiative process. Although this lawsuit really much so is kind of centered around the language on the ballot, not necessarily the amendment being on the ballot. So
yeah, I'm with Sage. It seems unlikely that the justices are going to say, you know, the legislature can go to them and say, well, you guys screwed this thing up in July, so let us overturn it and fix it. And you know, in the process, we're going to, you know, have this deceptive or misleading or Orwellian language, as it's been called, on the ballot before voters. It feels like that undermines the judiciary's role. And I think, like Sage said, trying to, you know, speak with a unified voice, and David referred to, I think it's going to be a steep hill for the state to climb, but, you know, stranger things have happened. So stay tuned.
David Magleby, final thought.
Yeah, I think Judge Gibson made it hard for the state Supreme Court to reverse her by including, as she did, the notification requirement being disregarded. So it's a debatable point about what language is in and out. I can understand that being debated, but the legislature erred in a fundamental way by not following its own laws. And that gives Judge Gibson and the state Supreme Court a narrow, but still, I think, quite potent legal argument to say, no, you got to play by the rules. You want to change the rules. Maybe you can do that through whatever process, but you didn't play by the rules. Therefore, nope, she's right.
And I would just add to that, if the Utah Supreme Court says the language can be stricken because of that failure to publish the text of the amendment in newspapers, it's been required since the Constitution was first ratified, that jeopardizes Amendments A, B, and C as well. Amendment A, remember, is one that the Utah Education Association is currently opposing because it would remove the remaining earmark for public ed. So they're fighting that, and they're going to be watching that with a close eye too.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good talking with you all.
Robert Gerke, he's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Sage Miller is a politics reporter for KUER. And David Magleby is professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on YouTube. We're at KUER 90.1. Stevie Shaughnessy is our intern. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.